call from mom. Answer it. Call silence.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey guys, brand new podcast. I'm in host voice. My wife's cleaning out the chicken coop. And I'm getting ready to go to San Antonio at Laugh Out Loud Comedy Club down by the Riverwalk. Excuse me. It doesn't behoove me to say this, but I also point out that that Felipe Esparza is down at in San Antonio this weekend too. He's at the Improv. I only say it because he's a fantastic comic. One of my favorite comics. No joke. And I know you guys love him, so I thought I'd let you guys know. He's down there too. So go see two comedy shows or just see one. It doesn't piss me off. I want you guys. I want to share with you guys the real. Keep it real, motherfucker. And I'd go see Felipe. Definitely. I wouldn't see him over me. I mean, but I'd definitely go see him. Anyway, let's just fucking do this. Laugh Out Loud San Antonio, Helium Portland the next week, Richmond Funny Bone the weekend after that. I think those shows are almost sold out. So if you're in Richmond, get your tickets now. Call in Sick to Work show in D.C. sold out in 1 minute. I bring that up on this podcast. I was very, very proud. I got a text from Elliot, and he was like, dude, 1 minute. I was like, shut the fuck up. The next week, Columbus Funny Bone. I am at the Columbus Funny Bone on the 17th of March. St. Patty's Day, doing a call in sick to work show. That show will sell out. It sold out last year, and we will be drinking all night. And then I got a show the next day at some fucking college. Good luck, college. I will do my best to be sober. On the 25th is Doug Stanhope's birthday. Send him a card. Send him a present. I think we should all send him a present. I'll get his address. I'm sure he puts it out. But just let's all send him birthday presents. The Omaha Funny Bone the weekend after that. By the way, Omaha's got one stop. I'm going to try to do a podcast with Larry the Cable Guy that weekend. Oh, three eggs? Oh, our chickens are laying eggs again. Fantastic. You stepped in dog shit? Oh, fuck. Omaha Funny Bone. Omaha has a direct flight. I'd like to do a podcast with Larry the Cable Guy. Can everyone hit up Larry? So I'll be there the 31st and 1st of April. Wise Guys Salt Lake City, Wild West Comedy Festival, although I cannot find myself. Huntsville, Alabama the day before that. Shut the fuck up. I got a cold. I got it in London. All right, let's just start the podcast. Real quick, Pete Holmes' show on HBO, Crashing, is fucking awesome. So if you haven't seen it, put it in your DVR, watch it. Thank you, everyone who DVR'd my comedy special. I just got the numbers on how many people DVR'd it, and I was astounded. So if you haven't DVR it, Artie Lang's fucking amazing. Pete obviously is amazing. It's great. From beginning to end, it really is fucking great. So check it out. And if you're a comedy fan, you'll just love it. It's everyone's in it. Big J's in it. It's really fucking phenomenal. Is that it? No advertiser this week? No advertiser. I'm coughing like a motherfucker. Today's guest is a British comedian. This is a podcast I am very, very proud of. I think you're going to absolutely love it. It is the reason I have a podcast. The reason I have a podcast is not for this moment. I'm very uncomfortable in this, by the way. I feel like I ramble. Anyway, the reason I have it is so I can hang out with other comics, get to know them, and make friends. That's the main thing. You know, I don't get... It's hard to schedule time to like hang out with people when you're a grown man with kids. I have a hard enough time calling in my avails to the store because my wife's like, you're home for three fucking days. Be a dad. But this is a perfect reason to have a podcast. It's the reason I'm friends with Ryan Singer, with Shane Moss, with Duncan, we all just hung out and podcast. And you spend 3 hours with somebody and you really just talking, you and them, one-on-one. And it's amazing. And this podcast is the perfect example. I said to everyone I was coming out to UK. You guys hit me up with a bunch of comics. I reached out to a couple of them. And this guy was one of them. His name's Al Murray. And He very casually, we talk about this in podcast, he very casually goes, yeah, I can do it. Like, just very flippant. By the way, he replied, he's got like 500,000, 400,000 Twitter followers. So I was like, wow, this guy's oddly approachable. He came out to where I was staying. I was staying at a friend's house. He came over. He was dressed really nicely. I got to mention that. And we just talked about everything. First of all, I became obsessed with what he's probably best known as. He's extremely, extremely famous in the UK for a character he does called the Pub Landlord. The Pub Landlord is this pub owner, I think. He lives there and runs the pub, but he's like bald, he's gruff, he's xenophobic, and he's always believes Britain is the answer to everything solutions. He hates France. He hates the Germans. He hates Spaniards. It's a character. I think we'd call it a one-man show in our country, but in Europe where they take more chances doing stand-up, this is what he's known as, and it is fucking hilarious. I Googled it when I first hit him up, and I watched a little bit, and I was like, oh, this is good. This is really funny. And then throughout the process of getting ready to go to London and preparing for the interview, I started watching a lot of it, and then I started obsessing with it. And I was like, this is fucking, it's genius. It really is. And I think it's ripe. I think our country's ready for something like this. I mean, I think our country, with what we're going through and what everyone feels and everyone's opinions, dude, this is quote unquote just taking the piss out of all of it. It really is just being funny. And if you want, go and Google him put him on YouTube. There's one he does with the Globe where he breaks down every country and its direct effect, or the direct effect Britain had on either its success or its failures, or why it is where it is, or it is amazing. And I promise you, if you watch it, you will love it as much as I do. And if this podcast isn't to bring shit to you that you've never seen before and you get introduced to, and then all of a sudden you fucking love, then what the fuck is this podcast about? And this, my friends, you are going to fucking love. It's like almost a 3-hour, 2-hour, and 30-minute conversation that is seamless. We talk about comedy. We talk about stand-up. We talk about doing the road. We talk about kids. We talk about the Pub Landlord. We talk about how it affects, and I try to convince him to come to the States, and I just got a text from him the other day saying they're looking at September in New York. So, and I can promise you, if he comes to do a show in September in New York, I'm flying out with my wife and we're going to watch this fucking show. It's that fucking good. If you're British, you already know who this guy is. This description's for all the Americans like myself. I know everyone in comedy, and when I didn't know him, I was like, man, more people need to. So without further ado, let's start the goddamn podcast, huh? You want to do it? Let's do it. I'll see you this weekend in San Antonio with my ears pierced. That's right. I pierced my ears with my daughter. And because she didn't want to do it. There's a video on my Instagram. Go check out my Instagram. Ladies and gentlemen, today's podcast, the Pub Landlord himself, Al Murray.
This is the
podcast. Dude, there we go. Great.
Yeah, that's perfect. This is... I don't know if, I mean, New York does podcasts a lot too, but more, I mean, LA, this is yeah. Like, I mean, I don't know a comic in LA that doesn't have a
podcast. That doesn't have one, right.
They have a couple. Like, I think Chris D'Elia has like 3 podcasts.
Really?
Well, he had, you know who Chris D'Elia is?
No.
Very funny, really good looking,
yeah.
Young, talented, right. Sitcom actor.
I hate him.
Automatically, right? No, he just got a new one and... Yeah, I don't
know. Are they about different things? Does he talk?
I don't know. I haven't seen his new one. His new one is in the Bill Burr model,
right?
Where it's just him speaking.
All right, okay.
This is like so. This is the older format. I started mine like 4 years ago.
Yeah,
it's just comics talking to comics.
Yeah.
Usually
yeah.
I get drunk, but I got a show tonight.
Where are you playing tonight?
I don't know. The Bill Murray. The Angel Comedy at the Bill Murray.
Really? I don't know that one. You see, I've not been a circuit comic for a really long time.
Really?
I've been doing my own thing, so... Yeah.
I'm got to tell you, I'm absolutely fucking fascinated by you. Joking around. The Pub Landlord?
Yeah.
I love that fucking dude.
Oh, thank you very much.
I love him.
He's not me. I hope you're not disappointed.
What I find so fascinating is, like, you know, we don't really have that
as much in the States.
Yeah.
Like it would, it reminds me of like a real, like legit, like what you guys do in Edinburgh, like a real presentation, like a, like a theater show.
Yeah. Yeah.
Almost what Colin Quinn's doing, but with a character.
Yeah. But that's what, that's where I come. That's the thing I came through was doing Edinburgh's. I was, my first in sort of contact with doing stand-up or doing comedy at all was doing stuff in Edinburgh when I was a student, doing review and doing sketches. And so I've always kind of had that that mindset on. And I much prefer stand-up over – I prefer long stuff to go and see. I always think stand-up at its best is a long con rather than a mugging, you know. Like,
yeah.
Like, it, you know, because the show I'm doing – the show I'm touring right now – is 2 1-hour halves, you know, and by the end of that, you're in a completely different headspace, the audience is, to where you started. You know, you can take them somewhere else altogether, and that's what I always wanted to do. So
wait, what's the show you're touring right now?
Well, I'm touring a show right now. It's a pub landlord show called Let's Go Backwards Together, which is about kind of the political mood.
So wait,
here explain, right now,
explain. So I'm going to do my best to explain the pub landlord, you correct me.
Okay, yeah, sure.
It is a guy who I'm assuming probably voted for Brexit.
Well, yeah, if he hadn't faked his own death.
Four times.
Four times in pub fires to claim the insurance, yeah.
And he has a distaste for the French and the German.
Yeah. Yep.
And like, I mean... See, I won't say as Americans. I'll just say I don't really have a grasp of globally what's going on at all.
Yeah,
ever.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, when you go through and you break down the countries with the big globe.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's fucking hysterical.
Oh, thank you, man.
And it's a guy who runs, I guess it's an older version. I don't know if they exist anymore. Do they?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a guy that would own his own pub. It's almost like what Louis did on
Yeah, kind of.
Boris and Pete.
Yeah, kind of. Although we've, I mean, the thing with the pub in this country is, you know, the British like to go on about how much we love our pubs and all this sort of thing, but they're a dying institution. So there's a kind of vibe around them that they're like looking backwards and that they're full of people. And also there's that drinker's logic that you'll encounter at, you know, either 2 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the afternoon here. Cause you know, you've got this. So what I mean, the character came about, I suppose the best way to explain it is like how I arrived at the idea is I was doing a show in Edinburgh with a comic called Harry Hill who did a thing called TV Burp for like a decade, which is kind of like TV Soup, a kind of thing like that, a clip show. And we were really good pals. And we were doing a show in Edinburgh and we had a gap to fill in the show, you know, where we didn't have a compere basically. And the show was on in a bar. And I said, well, why don't we say that the compere's not shown up? And the barman's offered to fill in. And he was kind of like, yeah, whatever. You know, he basically didn't give a shit. So that's what I went on and did and just started making this stuff up. And the character is, he's fiercely patriotic.
Yeah.
But to the point of massive self-contradiction, you know. So, which I think very often if you are fiercely patriotic, you end up having to do that to yourself. You end up having to contradict yourself and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Cancel yourself out, you know? So he's massively patriotic. He's misogynistic isn't right because he doesn't hate women.
Yeah.
He's terrified of them, you know? It's a world of difference, you know?
Yeah.
He's completely confused about the modern world, about ideas about sexuality, all this sort of stuff. But mainly he's using all these... The xenophobia in it is he's using all these other places and other things to define himself to say, I'm not that... And that's it, basically. And the thing is, the when I started doing the character, the margins for what the limits appeared really quickly. And once you've worked out the margins, I can't remember which artist was says the great most important part of a portrait is the frame. Once you've got the frame worked out, you can basically I find I can feed any subject into the character, and because it's a point of view, and it comes out the other end funny.
Oh, it's so.
Because the thing is, I couldn't do myself. I wouldn't know where to begin if I had to go on and be me. I mean, the people I really admire, people like you, can talk about yourself, talk about things that have happened to you. You know, I can't. I don't even know how to. I don't know how to do that.
But you do it so well through that other voice. I mean,
yeah, kind of, which is kind of what I'm doing. Yeah,
it's so. You know, I for a second felt that American comedy was moving that direction. We had gotten so politically correct that the people I love the most, I noticed that they were doing characters and saying really horrible things,
yeah,
so they wouldn't get in trouble.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And like they would say these things, and I would, and but because it was behind a character, there was no attachment to it.
Yeah,
so no one could complain.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's kind of one of the things you hope to be able to gain from doing a character is, yeah, at least. I mean, what, one of the things you try and do is like, because if you can't talk about something at all, how are you ever gonna? Are you even going to check that it's something you shouldn't be talking about? You know what I mean?
Isn't, yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
How can you ever test an idea if you're just not allowed to talk about it at all?
Uh-huh.
And I think there is that. There's always been that here. There's always been that sort of. I mean, I loathe to use the words political correctness because it's used politically to talk about something else anyway. But like,
yeah,
you know, it's a new set of etiquette. The way that you used to be, comics used to be racist, and now we'd rather they weren't. I mean, it's a shift in etiquette, taste, manners, as much as it is anything else, you know. But I think if you can't say stuff, how are we ever going to bare our teeth at it and go, yeah, that's bullshit? You know what I mean? Which is sort of what I'm doing with the character. But then I get told I shouldn't even be doing that too, you know.
Really?
I get criticism that, you know, I get the people say, they say they don't get your act. Racists or xenophobes agree with your act. They don't get that it's a joke. And I sort of think that's funny, more than anything else.
I can imagine there are people that watch it and go, that's what I'm talking about.
Anyone
who does that is like, your part of you is like, I can't believe that you're missing out on the irony of this material. Like, but in a weird way, I find myself getting, like, when, like, you said something about Spain. You're like, the character says half of them are taking naps.
You're
talking about siestas, and fucking.
Well, the thing is, a lot, you know, cultural differences aren't necessarily good or bad, are they? They're just differences, and some of them, things like people taking a siesta. I think that strikes me as absurd, right? And finding that absurd doesn't degrade siestas, doesn't undermine Spanish culture. It's just me going, well, I find that ridiculous. I don't need a nap in the afternoon. What's wrong with you people? That's all there is to it. You know, there's this, the idea that that is somehow some sort of existential attack on something, which is what we should, you know, which is the things we should be worried about in this world, you know, is silly.
It really is.
You know what I mean? And I don't mind saying it's silly and thinking, and I don't mind. And if someone tells me I'm wrong, fine. We one of the things we've all got to be able to do a bit more is disagree. You know, you know what I mean? And it not be at the end of the world.
Yeah, it is one of those things. And one of the things I always felt the coolest thing about this is America has, and I'm sure you've noticed this, but we have such an obsession about race.
Yeah.
And we all get, every time we come over here and do stand-up, another comic will always say, you guys are obsessed about race.
Yeah.
That's all you guys talk about.
Yeah.
But I felt like when I was watching that, I was like, I can't believe some American hack hasn't seen this and said, oh, I'm just going to do that, my version of that guy. Because right now in our country, dude, that character, I mean, I don't know.
But it's just an archetype. The pub landlord, it's an archetype. Because it's Archie Bunker.
It's Archie Bunker.
You know, yeah. Yeah.
But I can't.
Which is Alf, which was here first as Alf Garnett, you know, and Archie Bunker was franchised off of a sitcom from here.
Really?
Yeah. This guy, Johnny Spate, was a really like socialist left wing writer, wrote Alf Garnett, and it's a Jewish guy who played him, a guy called Warren Mitchell. And it was massive here. That show was enormous.
Really?
And colossally misunderstood. You know, you had people, you know, Warren Mitchell would go to a football match and people would come up to him and say, yeah, you're fucking right about the Jews, man. And he'd go, I'm Jewish.
Yeah.
I'm Jewish. What do you want? Or they go, you're right about the blacks. And he'd be like, the joke's on you, buddy. And they wouldn't know what to make of it. And their creation basically spun out of their control. And Archie Bunker is the American, you know, they did explicitly franchise it to there.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, it's got that lineage. But the thing is that, you know, the guy who says terrible things, the archetype, that archetype goes back forever. You know, it's you laugh at the fact that he's saying terrible things because we know they're terrible. You know, come on. I mean, it's the idea that you shouldn't be doing that now is kind of weird, you know, but they recently, The BBC here did this series of where they did all their old sitcoms. They redid a load of old sitcoms, recast them, did them in a sort of retro style. And they did that one, and they did Till Death Do Us Part, it was called. And they hid it away, and they cut right back on it. Because he would use what completely forbidden language now in that show.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Can I find those online?
Yeah, you'll be able to find those online, yeah.
Oh, shit.
I mean, they've not aged well, but at the time they were like, you know, they were when we only had 2D TV channels, you know, the comedy that was on at 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock in this country, you would reach everyone and could be really incendiary like that, you know.
I had a joke. I've kind of tried to rework it recently, but one of the punchlines about it was I wrote it. It happened right around 9/11.
Yeah,
and I was at a bar with a black dude, and a Middle Eastern guy came in.
Yeah,
in real life, he didn't do anything.
No,
but in the joke, I say, and this is when you can know that you're lying in a joke.
Yeah,
I needed some interaction, so I had him order a beer, which is so ridiculous because I didn't even realize that until recently when I tried to pick up the joke again.
Yeah.
And I was like, why would he order a fucking beer if he's in a fucking robe and a hat? Like, he would never order a fucking, what, Johnny Walker Black? Like, no. And the black guy, he did it loud. And the black guy thought he blew up. He was like, ah.
Yeah.
And so then the black guy and I are watching him. We're profiling him. And then the guy leaves, and the black guy, in real life, the black guy said to me, I hope that motherfucker's not on my plane. And I was like, yeah. And then I was like, oh, my God, how crazy is it that me and a black guy are being racist together.
Yeah, yeah.
That we're committing a hate crime together. How far have we come?
Yeah,
we're
brought together. Yeah,
they were brought together. And then one of the lines I used to say in it, because one of the things that blew me away in that moment that I never could quite explain was, it's interesting that he shared racism with me.
Yeah.
Because if I am racist, I don't like him either. Like,
Yeah.
It's, and the line I said, how does he know my racism stops at Middle Eastern people? And I would get people coming up to me after shows going, yeah, my racism doesn't stop there either. And I would be like, no, you're missing the fucking point.
Yeah.
And so I stopped telling it altogether because I didn't like that people thought.
Yeah, but you know what? If I'd stopped doing my act because I was worried that people might misinterpret it, I'd have stopped, you know, 23 years ago.
So how long have you been
doing it? I started doing it like that time in Edinburgh was in 94 where I sort of did it embryonically. And then I got onto the comedy circuit here. When I was sort of working in the 90s, you could do 50 gig. You could do 400 or 500 gigs a year. You could just hammer it, and you'd do, you know, four or five. I think the most I ever did on a Saturday night was five shows, and I'd drive around town in this car, and you'd, you know, the bigger clubs. There was the Jonglers in Camden, and then one in Battersea, so the North London and South London. What you could do is go on first at one, last at the other, and then get, you know, and get back and try and thread one into the journey.
Really?
And I used to do all that. And I kind of figured I'll do this, you know, 400 gigs a year for 4 years. And if I come out the other end and I'm still like not sure of what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I'll give up.
Jesus.
And that was the brilliant thing about the London circuit. And I remember you'd talk to Australian comics and you'd meet American comics and, you know, how completely different the circuit was here. You know, once you broke through, you'd be doing 20s every night. And then there's the 40s, you know, extended sets. So you'd get into doing that as well. And that's the thing I was really interested in, which would then feed into Edinburgh where you have to do an hour. So I think I did 2-3 years and then of doing it on the circuit. And then I got into going to Edinburgh and I did 4 Edinburghs in a row. And every year would write a new hour, literally at the end of the fringe, at the end of August, tear the set list up, start again. And really hammer into it because that was the way to make it expand and grow and, you know, all that shit.
We did Edinburgh, me and Patrice O'Neill.
Yeah.
And Rich Voss did Edinburgh in 90, I think, 99 or 99.
Yeah. 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 That's 99 was the last year I was doing it really like in earnest. And then basically I got to the point where I could play theatres on tour in the UK and I could. So then you're doing your own thing. And I've found it's all got a lot easier since I'm doing my own thing. I'm set in my ways and I'm kind of, you know, for that reason, kind of lazy about a lot of stuff. But I don't like being on bills because you've then got to, if you're on a bill and someone's really good, I have to come on and lay out my stall and sort of start again. Whereas if they're coming to see me in a theatre with no support, do a couple of hours, you know, you come on and they're there to see you, and you can start from kind of, you know, couple of dozen yards down the track, you know what I mean?
Yeah, they're
on your terms and they're to see you and all that sort of thing. Whereas if I'm on a bill, like back in the old days, I get all nervous and I'm like, oh, fuck.
You know, I just had that realization today.
Right.
Like today, and it's so crazy. I would be very nervous right now about my show tonight.
Yeah.
If I was at the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
Like I've done the Comedy Store and I was almost uneased the entire day, stomach bothering me.
Yeah.
But knowing that I'm doing a show for legit my fans, like people that bought my tickets, I just go, oh, I can't really fuck up. I mean, I can get too drunk to perform. That has happened. But I'm not, but like for the most part, like I go, I'm just going to go in. I literally don't have an opening act, and I'm trying to call this kid Pierre and to see if he can just do like 10 minutes in front of me, you know, just to warm him up.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I was like, I bet I could just send my wife up. They know who my wife is.
Yeah.
And just have my wife go, hey, y'all.
Yeah, how you doing?
You guys
want
to see Bert? All right, here he is. You know? but yeah, I think that's – I just thought of that today. I was like, oh, I am never going to be flying over here to be doing sets at the store.
Mm.
As fun as that is – for me, and it's cool. I was like, I just will do small theaters and I'll do it once a year. I really enjoy London.
Yeah, well, the scene here is brilliant. And,
it really is. Now, what is the difference? Now, you've been in comedy,
nearly 30 years. I mean,
30 years.
Since 1991, really, is when I started earning money. So
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
I've been in it almost 20.
Yeah.
And I feel like I started feeling old today. Like, I was like, I just... I'm overwhelmed. This is this will end up in a bit somewhere, but I'm overwhelmed in the history this country has with we went to the dungeon thing, and like the concept that there was a like it doesn't really exist in America except in slavery, but the concept that free will wasn't what it is today. Like,
oh no,
you could be put in a dungeon. And they could cut off your genitals and burn them in front of your face. And there wasn't a form you could fill out to get that person in trouble. Like, I'm overwhelmed by that. And it was giving me panic attacks all day today.
Well, you know, a friend of mine is a beef eater at the Tower of London, right? And, you know, one of the yeoman warders there. And he's given me the, like, you know, the midnight tour, which is really, really, it's an amazing place.
Oh, like, my daughters were lit, like, when they had... literally hard-ons for beef eaters. They were like, oh, we're gonna fuck with him, Dad. Like, Isla's like, I'm gonna heckle him. I'm gonna talk about his mom. I go, Isla, no, you're not. I can't let you be that kid, honey. Hey, your mom's a whore. You know, like. But yeah, we saw the beef eaters yesterday, and they were blown away.
Yeah, it's amazing there. But apparently the torture they used to do, the people that signed the. You had to sign a legal warrant to be able to torture someone, and then you had to do it yourself. So there's the torture implements at the Tower. And so the politician, you know, the Privy Council or whatever they were called, he'd sign the warrant, I'm going to torture this guy, and then he'd have to do it himself. They wouldn't get someone else in to do it. And you kind of think, wow, they sort of, because it's how brutal all that is.
Oh, and, my God.
And you know, it's none of it's very long ago, really. Especially really, not in this country.
It's so crazy. I'm obsessed with England now, or Great Britain. Great Britain.
Well, Great Britain is the island from here to the top of Scotland.
Okay.
And then the UK is England, Wales, Northern Ireland, and Scotland.
Yeah.
For the minute. And then Ireland, the British Isles, is all of it, including Ireland. It's so confusing. And people don't know that.
I definitely was. I learned a lot watching. I mean, I almost was like, in my head, I was like, I'm going to have him come over and explain what happened with Brexit and what happened with it. Because there's so much shit that, as us Americans, we just don't fucking know.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and... we got tickets to come over here. There was $340 for my wife,
brilliant,
and daughters each.
Yeah,
round trip.
Yeah, amazing.
And because my buddy's like, hey, if you ever going to come to London, do it now.
Yeah.
He's like, it's a good time. And I mean, I flew first class, but they flew coach. They seemed to love it.
I'm glad I'm not the only one who does.
How old are your daughters?
17 and 13.
17 and 13. Mine's 12 and 10.
Yeah,
yeah. And they're I can see the turn of the corner. Like, I can really see it. Like, I can see the oldest one.
Well, we're just emerging from the black hole with my first, with my eldest.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's fine. It's fine now. Fuck me. If we'd had this conversation 2 years ago, but there we are.
Are you serious?
Oh, yeah. She did that, you know, through, me and her mum are divorced. So you know, you kind of hand a kid a shit sandwich like that and they throw it back at you.
Oh, oh.
But there it is, you know.
do they have like any concept of your success?
Absolutely, yeah. Really? And in fact, right from when I started, I did a lot of TV about 10 years ago. Like I tried to get them to come to everything because we did a talk show with in character, you know, and you get celebrities on and be rude to them. It's really good fun. And you know, we had guys like Buzz Aldrin come on it, and you know, if you've got Buzz Aldrin on, you want your kids to meet him.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. So we did, they are really keyed into it. And my eldest, she comes to see the show quite regularly and she's going, oh, I like that bit, but have you got that bit the wrong way around? And all this sort of thing, which is just amazing.
Oh, my oldest yesterday, we're in the car and I said, you guys should come down to the show. It's late. It's like a 10 o'clock yeah. show. And my wife's like, that's too late. And Georgia, my oldest goes, are you doing any bits about us and in this new hour? Because we just subscribed to what you guys have been doing forever about getting rid of your hour and doing a new hour after you do your special. And I said, yeah, I have this ziplining joke. We went ziplining and it's a true story.
Yeah.
And so I start telling them the story and she goes, I didn't say that. And I go, yeah, I know, but you were emoting that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's hard for me to say, I could see it in her eye. Like, it's easier for, if you say something.
Yeah.
She goes, so you just basically lie? I go, no. She goes, you go up there and lie. Like, she overwhelmed by the fact that, like, and then I told another story, and she goes, hold on, that's a lie also. I go, it's not a lie, Georgia. I go, it's a joke. It's like a story. She goes, yeah, but I didn't shit in the bed. And I was like, no, but Isla shit her pants. And she's like, hold on, I wasn't even there that day. And I'm like, oh, my God. I was like, you know what, don't come to see the show. I don't need to see you. But, yeah, I can... What was your experience between like seeing Americans come to Edinburgh all those times? Can't use Rich Hall as an American.
Well, no, I can't. Can I? No,
because yours.
Well, the really
he's so good.
The really he's amazing comic. Yeah, but we won't talk about him.
Yeah.
No, the really interesting thing is in Edinburgh. I always used to, when I was doing at the Fringe properly, you know, in the late 90s, I'd be so envious of Americans because. There'd be this sort of exotic cultural cachet. You know, Brits love the sound of Americans talking about things smoothly and in a well-polished way. We just love it. It's fucking really? Catnip. It's crazy, and it's sort of that. So what you'd see is sometimes you'd see kind of okay American comics, but just because they've got this sort of, it comes across as like a complete, a sort of sense of it being complete because of the accent, because of the delivery and all this sort of thing. And so you'd see sometimes some years you'd think, why is he doing so well? Those jokes are okay, you know,
yeah.
But it's the sort of exotic cultural thing of Americans, you know. We got produce a lot of our own TV here, but all of our mainstream cinema here is Americans. Americans are glamorous. And when you hear Brits go, Americans are rude and stupid, it's nonsense. America is synonymous with glamour in lots of ways here. So American stand-ups come with that cachet, you know. Especially in Edinburgh, you know, guys, they've come to our little festival. It kind of turns into that, you know.
That's really interesting. We bombed every single night so bad. We were in the assembly room, halls.
Yeah.
And across.
Well, maybe it's changed. But
oh, it was so uncomfortable.
Really?
Oh, and it was like we were doing it. We never had a good audience, never got a good, never. Right. Turned a corner with bringing people in.
Really?
A lot of times. Yeah, we were just a small room.
Right.
And the majority of the time, there were people that didn't speak English. They'd end up in the wrong room.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And so we were just...
Well, that's the tourist end of town, though. That's the problem with the assembly rooms. That bit is that bit of town. Although it's not there anymore. Assembly's moved, so...
Oh, really?
Yeah, 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 because there was some... they rebuilt the building or something, and so the guy who owned the name took the venue somewhere else and all this shit. Now it's reopened. There's a new venue opened in the assembly rooms, but it's not called that. I mean, you know, this is like, you know, micro Edinburgh politics. But that's
changed.
Do you
still go back and do Edinburgh?
Yeah, I started going again about when was it? About 8 years ago, I started going back and doing like a weekend, and one weekend I relearned all the four shows I'd done in the 90s, did them all on consecutive days. Which,
oh, seriously?
Yeah. But that was such a mind fuck. That was like, I'd get these lists out, and because I hadn't recorded them or videoed any of them, get these lists out, and you know, you read the list and think, what the hell is that? You know, what is that? And how does it connect to that? And how do I end up here? And, you know, and very few punchlines written down, just sort of topic headings and...
Oh, really?
And the diversions that went with them, but not punchlines. So you'd be thinking, what is this? And the first show was... I kind of remembered. The second show I remembered really well because it was the first thing I'd sat down to write from start to finish and got it right. So I was really pleased with it. So it sort of stuck with me.
Yeah.
The fourth one, because we then went and toured it, and I did it like 300 times, and like, I could do it for you now. But the third one, I'd look at these lists and it'd be like, nah.
What was the premise of the fourth one?
Well, the fourth one, it was called And a Glass of White Wine for the Lady. But the fourth one, that was the last year I did Edinburgh properly. And I'd tried to be quite clever with the storytelling. And I was trying a bit hard. And that fourth year, I said to myself, just try and be entertaining. You know, like, stop trying to, like, weigh your brains on your sleeve, just do something entertaining from start to finish.
Yeah.
And that was the best show I'd written in a long way because I just sort of it took it easy in the way I approached it.
Yeah.
Which actually, when you're doing a character, is actually the smarter way to do it. The character will do the lifting if you've got the character right. You don't need to do any more than that. You know, that his point of view will carry an idea rather than you having to like lay out of things. I used to do these long, real long Shaggy Dog stories with diversions and all this sort of thing, you know, things that would go on for half an hour.
Yeah.
Cause I think I wanted people to be reassured that it wasn't just me like telling jokes and swearing and being in your face, that there was like some thought behind it. And then I thought, why am I doing this? It's really difficult to do. It was making real work for myself. And if you get it wrong, is when you get screw it up halfway through, you create problems for yourself. So I kind of had this epiphany of like, you know, the keep it simple, stupid thing, you know.
It's so funny I should take that approach. Right now I'm working on my new hour and I got recognized, I think, for one story.
Right. Yeah.
And it's a 13-minute story.
Yeah.
Very kind of very big tentpole story, and it took me a while to figure the story out.
Yep.
And then I was like, that's what I need this hour. And so part of me goes exactly what you just said. I go, I think the character like, our comedy is so different in America because people will write jokes,
yep,
and say, like, Amy Schumer got in trouble for a bunch of racist jokes.
Yeah, yeah.
And then she goes, that's a character I do on stage. That's actually that's not the American form.
Yeah.
The American form is to be you.
Yeah.
And but there are, like, we do have, like...
You do have some...
Larry the Cable Guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Judah.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, I think the thing with a lot of character acts is they kind of devolve into catchphrases and getting past that's quite difficult. I got caught in a bit of a catchphrase thing for a while, and the way to solve that was to never do them.
What was the catchphrase?
I had fucking loads, but I've got one that I always come back to, which is this, which is, if we didn't have rules, where would we be? France. If we had too many rules, where would we be? Germany. Which is like, if you want to sum up, like, what a lot of English people think of their nearest neighbours.
Yeah.
That's it. And then I'd always tag a third one on the end. So there'd be one. There's always a third one. So, and if we had rules insisting our kids take firearms into school, the US, or if we had rules allowing us to shoot our girlfriend while she was on the toilet, South Africa. That one worked because there'd always have to be a tag.
Yeah.
But But I at one point, you know, you'd come on and you'd feel the audience going, "Guys, come on, do it, do it." So, what in this current show, that comes up like kind of as an afterthought, an hour and a half into the show, because you just don't want to.
Yeah.
Sometimes you got to not give them what they want.
Because I feel like all I do is give people what they want.
Yeah.
Like I'm assuming you know nothing or little or to nothing about me.
I know enough. Yeah. But
I perform with my shirt off.
Yeah.
And but I feel like you come up with something that works. And then the second it works, you just go, I should distance myself from that.
Yeah.
Like I did this raffle. I did this raffle for the waitstaff recently.
Yeah.
And it went online and it got a bunch of views. But it's basically I just tell everyone in the audience to give Ford a dollar. And then we raffled off some of the waitstaff. I was in wherever I was this weekend in Seattle. I was in Seattle this weekend past. And the whole time they're like, you doing the raffle in the audience? And I'm like, ah, fuck.
Yeah.
If it wasn't such a great thing for the waiters who get like fucking $680.
Yeah.
And it changes their, I go, I'd never fucking do this again.
Yeah.
But as soon as you get something that works, you're like, huh?
Yeah. Gonna have to do it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Now what was like, you have a different accent than the pub landlord.
Yeah.
But like, so this blows me away. where is your act? What kind of English person are you?
What kind of English person am I? Well, my family's really quite. I mean, if you look me up on Wikipedia, it looks like I'm some sort of aristocrat. But my family are upper middle class. Because class, you say American comics obsessed with class. With race.
Yeah.
Class is one of the big things here.
And middle class here is different than our middle class.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, but that's because we've actually got an actual aristocracy that identifies as such and acts as such and is enshrined in our political system as such. You know, we got lords. You know, we've actually got that.
Yeah.
So,
the guy across the hall is a lord.
Yeah, there you are. You see. Yeah. I mean, and this is you'll find a lot of them in this part of town as well because this is a very. Yeah, I mean, this is you fall on your feet here, man. But yeah. But my family are quite. You know, if you look at it. I'm what you'd call kind of posh. But
can you hear that? Should I hear that in your accent?
Probably to an extent. But the thing is, I went to a private school and I went to Oxford University, you know, which is a smart school. What's that?
We must have said Alexa at some point.
Alexa thing.
So
oh, yeah.
We must have
said something that set it off.
Alexa.
But anyway, I've had, certainly what a young person, hip people call a, you know, I've got lots of privilege.
Yeah.
But the pub landlord definitely isn't that. And I get this criticism where people go, you're taking the piss out of the working classes with your act. You're a posh guy sneering at the working classes. And I kind of think that only really holds up if you think the working class are a bunch of blowhard xenophobes, right? In which case, you've got the, you're the one with the prejudice because you've not really thought that through. And I also kind of think we live in a, you know, although we have got this class system, we live in a fluid plural society where everyone's entitled to a point of view. If people are being ridiculous, they're fair game.
Yeah.
You know, what difference does it make where they're from? If someone's talking shit, we should be, if there's a, you know, a set of people who talk shit, we should be taking the piss. And we're in our politics right now and in this country, people are really beguiled by the idea of men of the people. You know, so I've got this, the pub landlord at the moment is saying that's what he is. Cause I think it's funny when anyone claims to be that. I think it's absurd and a really great thing to play with as a thing to take the piss out of.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, I mean, because it always ends up somewhere ridiculous, like in America where you've got, you know, an inherited billionaire has managed to position himself as a man of the people. It's amazing.
It's
amazing.
Mind-blowing what's going on in our country. Like, mind-blowing to the point where I go, like, sometimes I find what he says so comical.
Yeah.
Like, I laugh hysterically. Yeah. He did a interview with Joe, I think Joe Scarborough.
Yeah.
And I was howling laughing at the way he was talking.
Yeah.
Like, just like, yeah, screw him.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what? You're not allowed to, like, and then this morning, I know my wife said something and we've been out of the loop, but my wife's like, oh my God, they're holding like Senate hearings on him.
Yeah.
His involvement with Russia. And I'm like, are you like, this is,
it's amazing. It's like a sort of, giant live civics class, isn't it, as well? It's just it is amazing. But we've got something not the same here, but something similar here with this, you know, with the Brexit thing, which, you know,
Brexit wasn't about money. It was about immigration.
It's about immigration. It's about the idea that that we're not in control of our own government anymore. It's about all sorts of things. It's also kind of about the fact that, you know, since the crash in 2008, people's wages have stagnated and people are feeling hard done by. But I mean, I don't know what you think about this, but I think it's pretty amazing that in two of the richest countries in the world, people feel like they're being hard done by. I think that's quite interesting, because I go to Cambodia fairly often. I've got friends who live there, and I'm involved in a charity out there, and, you know, we built a school.
That's one of the things that fascinates about me about you. Like, I did read your Wikipedia page.
Yeah.
And you are not the stereotypical comic smoking weed and literally, like, playing Xbox and...
No, but the thing is the thing is, if I didn't have distractions, that's exactly what I'd be. I know myself well enough to know that my default position is lazy. My default position in life is bone idle, and that's why I work so hard. Because if I allowed myself to, I would sit and look out the window all day. That I'd be quite happy to do that.
Do you drink?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. What, yeah. Like, so how do you get out of lazy? Because I am lazy, and like I'm in the middle of three projects right now, and I cannot. I just am like. I'm like, I can't get moving forward. And I'm like, and we're starting a fourth project. And I'm like, yeah, I think I need an assistant. Like, I just can't. But you literally, I think you have like, what, four books? You have the tour. You have charities.
Yeah, yeah. And I've got a business making drum kits as well.
So, yeah.
Yeah. But it's basically, like I said, my default setting is bone idle. And if I don't give myself these things to do, nothing will happen. And I know that. That's a thing I really know about myself. And that's kind of I'm not a workaholic. I mean, I do take time off.
Yeah.
But there is this thing in me that you know, because I've been... This tour, when we're done, we've done 100 shows or something, and big, you know, big theatres, like 1,000, 2,000 seaters and all that sort of thing. And by the time we're done with that, I get in two frames of mind, like, I'm never fucking doing this again. When do we start again? You know, and actually at the end of this tour, I've got to stop doing live stuff for a couple of years, because I've got other things that have been crowded out by it, to be honest.
Really?
But my default setting would be like drinking beer and playing PlayStation, playing video games. But I know that if I let that in, next stop, my funeral, you know, 20 years time, having achieved nothing. So it's that, it's knowing it about myself. Because I do stay busy, yeah.
Yeah, you are busy. What's a typical tour look like for you? Do you start a tour and then hit all of...
Well, this one, the one we're doing at the moment is kind of typical. So we work backwards. So the first proper theatre dates were in mid-September last year. And so what we do is like a couple of weeks doing... rooms that get gradually bigger, like little arts theatres and arts centres, and then we end up in a proper theatre with a proscenium arch. And then, but before that, I've done Edinburgh, so I do Edinburgh for 10 nights or something, and then I'll do some... I live in Chiswick up the road, and there's a pub there with a little theatre, like, holds 50 people, so I do 5 o'clock in the afternoon there, do an hour there, lit with a piece of paper, you know, come on with a list and...
Really?
Do the topics off the list, and then come back a week later without, hopefully without the list, or what with whatever the changes are, and... learn it that way.
Yeah.
Which means, so that has to have happened in July, which means it needs to be written in June, which means, I mean, I need to have been thinking about it in May, you know, like this whole backdate thing.
That is really helpful if you set a goal and you go, like, I just on a phone call the other day said, I'm doing my hour in this city at this theater on this date.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we were like, great. And then I went, oh, fuck. And then I started going, man, I got to stop being lazy. And my lazy is on stage is probably not a textbook lazy, but what it is for me is not taking enough chances and going, I have a new story that I want to work on.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just going like, this is really killing. I'm going to stick with this and I'm going to fine tune it. I can't write. I can't like sit and just write out a bit. it needs to work itself out on stage. Yeah. And even if I take it and try to punch it up, and it needs to come out in the live venue for me. So I was supposed to do a smaller theater tour. But when I say theaters, it's not as big as yours.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like some 600 seaters.
Yeah, cool.
And I just pulled them, because I was like, no, I want to work the clubs and I want to work the whole weekend. I want to do six shows.
Yeah.
And really kind of figure out this hour. But that is a great way to go about it, is set yourself a date and then work backwards from there.
Well, that's how I've always done it. But I used to do that with Edinburgh. So, you know, you'd have – and I used to think doing a character, you can be particularly vulnerable to the idea that, oh, it's the same as last year. So I'd make sure the show, start to finish, the content was completely different. So all right, the attitude hasn't changed. The character and the approach hasn't changed, but the materials are different. So I really got in the habit of that deadline thing, but it gets harder every time, you know, every couple of years we come around. So what we do is, so it goes May, June, July, August in Edinburgh. We tour. So last year we toured September, October, November, right up to, end of November. And then I just started going back out again. So I had a couple of months off it over Christmas. But that then means, you know, the first gig when we're back comes up and I'm thinking, I can't remember a word of this stuff.
I used to like that. And then fucking Bill Burr got in my head and he goes, I hadn't done stand up in like a month.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I was at the store and I go, I love this feeling. And he goes, really?
Yeah.
He's like, I don't see it. I said, what do you mean? He goes, it just seems real rusty. And I was like, oh yeah, I am real rusty. I like the rust.
Yeah.
Personally, I think rust is healthy for me.
Yeah.
But I was like, but it's very different than when you are in that muscle where you've been working every fucking weekend.
Oh yeah. But I used to, when I did the circuit a lot, my then girlfriend, she'd go, oh, why do we never go away? And I think, well, the reason we never go away is because if I stop for like a week, that first gig, when I go back, you know, the Monday I first go back, I am shitting myself. And the words come out, and the words come out wrong. And they come out with the wrong pace or in the wrong, you know, all that. And so, like I said, we're restarting this last week. The week before last, it was really like, I was really nervous about it because also there's that thing. It's 25 quid a ticket. I'm going to talk to them for a couple of hours. You need to know what's in the show.
Yeah. What does your tour look like? Is it just you? Is it you and a manager? Is it you and
me and a tour manager? And then my tour manager I've worked with a really long time. He's a brilliant guy. And then we have a tech guy who goes out, because I've got a bar that, you know, that's got all the beer in it and the stuff.
I was like, wait, they have a real fucking kegerator.
Yeah. We refill a thing every night and I put a pump on it. It's not a proper keg.
Oh, okay.
No, it's just hand drawn.
You realize there's people like me in that audience going, oh, there's a real keg back
yeah,
there.
Yeah. Well, the thing, what's really interesting is what people think the bar, what is in the bar.
Yeah.
They always ask me, you know, is that real beer? And you think, come on.
Wait, is it not real beer?
No, it can't be.
Are you shitting me?
No, but I'd be twice the size.
Oh.
I wouldn't still be alive, because I drink in a proper, you know, if I'm not spilling it too much, because I try and spill as much as I can as well, because it's disgusting, this fake beer. If I was drinking the real thing, I'd drink 5 or 6 pints a night, and I'd be a mess. I'd be
Paul F. Tompkins, who I don't know if you know who he is.
No.
He's a comedian in the States, and we're not friendly, but he did a special that I really loved, and he drank 6 Guinness beers.
Jesus.
And I loved it. It was like I got to hang out with him that weekend. That's where our rift happened.
Yeah.
But I told him, I said, I really love that special, and I love that you drank 6 beers. I have the same thing. I think people think I'm drunk on stage.
Yeah.
I think they think I'm drunk all the time.
Yeah.
But I slow roll a vodka soda. Like, I'll sip it, but and then there are these shows, like tonight will be one of them, where shots will get sent to stage.
Yeah, yeah.
Cause you're here one night, it's fucking small crowd there, you know?
Yeah.
But that's so funny. I definitely thought it was real beer.
No, I'm sorry.
That's so
but
funny.
But there's a club I used to live over in Fulham, and there was literally a club at the end of my road. And they'd do this thing, if someone had dropped out, whatever, they'd call me, and if I was in, you know, find out if I was in, I'd put the outfit on, go over the road.
Yeah.
And that one, you'd think, well, I'll have one before I go on. I'll take one on with me. I'll accept any that are offered. And I remember I did a show where I would have drunk five or six, and I think I expect it was rubbish. I expect the show was shit, but I had a fantastic time.
Yeah,
and you know, and I think what should have taken about 40 minutes took an hour and a half as well, because you could just get bogged down in that.
Uh-huh.
Extra detail and the extra telling and the, you know.
That is where I say it's when I get gluttonous.
Yeah.
If I'm drinking, I'm gluttonous on stage.
That's the right word for it. That's exactly the right word for it.
I've only had one show that I've done blacked out that I don't remember.
Right.
And that was in Tampa. I do a tour called Call In Sick to Work.
Yeah.
I go in, I do radio, I drink on air, and then I go right to the club and everyone calls in sick to work. And we do a club at like a matinee, like a 10.
Oh, amazing. What a brilliant idea.
Yeah, I think we're turning it into a radio show. I don't know what we're going to do, but it's a live event. And I mean, I mean, this is, I'm bragging right now, but I just announced one in DC at 10 a.m. yesterday.
Yeah.
And it sold out in a minute.
Jesus, and that's brilliant.
It sold out in a fucking minute. I was blown away. My buddy Elliot called me. He's like, dude, it sold out in 1 minute. But they're really fun because it's day drinking. It's like everyone's favorite time to drink.
God, so that is brilliant. Everyone calls in. Brilliant idea.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I'm doing one for St. Paddy's Day in Columbus. That'll be sold out.
Yeah.
But they're just a blast. And I did one in Tampa and I drank. I overestimated what I could handle at radio.
Yeah.
And by the time I got on stage, they sent so many shots that I woke up at my parents' house. My parents live in Tampa.
Yeah.
And I went, how did I get off stage? Not how did I get here? How did I get off stage?
Oh,
and I
man.
Didn't remember. Oh. But everyone brings up that show and they're like, that was fucking amazing.
And did they enjoy, was it a good show though?
They loved it. they wanted me to tell that one story, my machine story. They're like, tell the machine. And I was like, and I was like, I'm not telling the fucking machine story. I'm going home. And I walked off stage.
Really?
Yeah. I don't remember it. I don't remember it at all. That's so funny.
Oh, that's brilliant, man.
Yeah. Now, have you ever thought about taking your tour to the States?
Well, I did a pilot for Fox 10 years ago, I think, abortively, which was a really mad, weird, interesting experience. But I've never gigged in the US, and I'd really like to, but it's kind of that thing of it's sort of why I've got to stop in June, is to stop touring here all the time, to find some time to do things like that and try some other places and suck it and see elsewhere, because it would be really interesting to try and make the act come across in the States. Because the thing is in I've played Australia quite a lot of or a fair bit. I've been to Hong Kong, New Zealand. I go to Dubai, and then I've done shows in France and in Belgium. And one of the things that happens here that doesn't happen when you take the act abroad is English people get in this knot. They go, "Is he laughing at us? Should we be laughing at this? Sometimes they think, what's the target? Where does the line fall?" You go to Australia, they think, "Yeah, that's what you've." That act is what you fucking poms are like.
Yeah.
And you're like, great, brilliant. And we can just have a party with this then. We could just have fun and we could talk about all sorts of stuff and we can push the line if we want, because you get what the idea is. And it's the same when you go to France, you go to anywhere else. But I mean, I don't necessarily know what, because Australia, New Zealand both got this cultural contact with here that's really different to the States. So it'd be amazing to know how it would work in the States.
Well, I think you could patch together, from what I've watched, shit that would work in the States really well.
Yeah.
Like really, like, I mean, just, I mean, you walking through the countries for me is hilarious, because there's parts in Alabama that would the Sex Pistols. I'm a big Sex Pistols fan.
Right.
They did a tour. They assumed that since they were working class, then they'd do a tour of the South.
Right.
Because that's where working class people were.
Christ.
And it did not work well.
No.
But now where we're at today, I think it would work really well. I think that there is you could do parts of your act that, or cater it just to the US.
Yeah.
To talk to the US, and I think it would fucking destroy.
Well, I'd be really interested. I mean, I'd really be interested in trying it. And the thing is, I've got, you know, I've got about 20 hours of material now all backed up. So it would be a question of like, I could really cherry pick.
You can cherry pick and destroy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a great, I mean, I really just, all I said was like, it's serendipitous. Cause I put out online, I'm doing a show. Yeah. And then the only, I think you're the only name I got back
right.
that everyone like consistently was like, yeah, you guys got to get together.
Oh, right.
And so I hit you up and you were like, yeah, I'm around. And then I was like, oh, he's so lackadaisical. Like the way you were, I didn't even look you up. I went, he's so lackadaisical. He must not be working. Cause you're like, yeah, I'm around. And then I was like, oh, and I was like, okay. And then I looked and I was like, whoa, holy shit. You're like, I think you have like 500,000 Twitter followers. And I was like, oh my God. And then I Googled you and I was watching it. And I was like, I was blown away. I was like, this is what our country, this is what America would love right now.
Well, I mean, it is interesting though that character isn't kind of a thing in the US. Because the thing is what you do have, you've got, you know, your Saturday Night Lives and stuff where people have to play characters all the time, where it kind of is part of the, certainly the TV interface for people with comedy. So it's kind of strange it's not in stand-up because of the freedoms it grants you. You know, you can talk about, you can literally take an opposite view of what you mean and go like that with it and talk about it.
When we do get it, it's American, the comics attack it.
Yeah.
Like Larry the Cable Guy is a perfect example.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of comedy. My wife's a redneck. She's from the South.
Right.
And so she took me to go see the Blue Collar Comedy Tour in the theaters in LA. I'm a fucking working comic and I'm sitting in a theater by ourselves. No one's in there at the Arclight and I'm watching it, but I bought the character. I thought that was him. Yeah. And then I'm in Omaha and I'm talking to someone and I was like, maybe I talked to him on the phone. I might've talked to him on the phone.
Yeah.
But he didn't have an accent. And I was so caught off guard and I was like, hold on. And I think I pulled Colleen aside. I was like,
yeah,
Larry doesn't have an accent. She's like, no. And I was like, hold on. He doesn't have any accent. Like and she was like, no, he doesn't have an accent. And I was like, no, like no fucking way. That's like, if I found out Rogan wasn't inhaling his weed, you know, like it just is so crazy because that is who we are. But I think over here, it's so different. I think it's a very different character. You know, I was just talking to someone the other day and I was like, the thing that made Jim Jeffries so big in America was that he's super honest, he's super vulnerable, and he is who he is. When he says shit when he went on Opie and Anthony, I think that's where he really blew up.
He
was just talking about the most filthy shit.
Yeah.
And he was owning it.
Yeah.
And Americans love that, like, you know, I don't know. They sometimes attack it also, but like, but I think that was the thing. But I when I was watching it, I was like, this could tour America very easily.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's interesting. Well, I'll talk to my manager.
Yeah. Like do like the Wilbur, you know?
Yeah.
Do the Wilbur. And that's like the gauge, the barometer of how you'll do in theaters, but do the Wilbur and Boston. They'd fucking.
Yeah, I don't see why they wouldn't. What I know of Boston, I don't see why it wouldn't work there.
Have you been to the States?
Just a bit. Like I say, I made this thing in LA in 2000. When was it? 2008, I think. But I've been on holiday there a lot because I love it.
Yeah,
really love the place. Fascinated by it. But I've never worked there apart from this bit of telly.
I think it would be great. To get you, like, to have you do like the New York Comedy Festival, or something like that.
Well, this is great because I, like I said, I'm planning to sort of do a different thing with the next 2 year cycle when we finish in June because I am sick of the motorway food in this country. Like,
because
that's what we, you know, me and my tour manager, we're really really close friends, but we have got nothing to say to each other anymore. You know, you sit in that car.
Yeah.
It's another 3-4 hour drive somewhere. You know, what are we going to talk about? We compare notes on ex-wives, dramas with our kids. We put the sports radio on. You know,
what's your sport? Soccer.
I'm a rugby and cricket fan.
Ah, cricket.
Yeah.
Do you know a comic named Alistair Berry?
No, I don't know.
Alistair Berry and this guy Andre Vincent.
I know Andre, yeah.
Yeah, Andre, and we did South Africa together.
I know Alistair, of course I do. Yeah.
It was a bunch of us. Yeah. It was Steve Hughes.
Yeah.
It was a bunch of us.
Oh, superb.
But I was mocking cricket to them.
Oh, man.
And Andre explained why I was wrong, and it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And he was like, first of all, he was like, you would like 20-20 cricket.
Yeah.
He's like, that's more your speed. So we went to a 20-20 cricket match with Carl Barron. Do you know that guy?
Yeah.
Carl Barron knew the team, Australian team.
So they got
us like in the box.
Fucking brilliant.
It was amazing. It's basically, for those of you listening, 20-20 cricket is home run derby.
Yeah.
It's imagine if they said, all right, so Boston's playing New York, and this is going to be dated, but Alex Rodriguez is the only batter that's going to bat, and Big Poppy is the only batter that's going to bat, and they'll be batting every time.
Yeah.
And basically, we just want to see them hit home runs.
Yeah.
And that is what – and it was fucking awesome.
A 2020 cricket is really brilliant, but then I really love the test match format.
Now, this is why Andre goes, you're an idiot, and I'll tell you why. And he goes – he's like, wouldn't it be cool if – early Friday morning, your football game started, and they played one game throughout the weekend. So all weekend you could keep going back to the TV and go, oh, wait, what's the score? Yeah. I was like, I'd fucking love that. He's like, it's a mini series of a sport. Yeah. And he was like, that's what test cricket is. And it lasts like 5 days.
Yeah. And they can play for 5 days and it ends in a draw.
Yeah,
which is the most beautiful. The thing is once you really get into cricket, there's this thing at the draw, which is the, where no one wins, but that can save a series, you know, because if you're 1-0 up and you draw the next four games, you win the series, you know, you win the five matches.
Yeah.
And it is an amazing, I absolutely love it. And I've done some stuff with the England team and all that sort of thing. And I've done dinners for them and really it is externally impenetrable, cricket as a sport. You think, what the hell's going on here? But once you get into it and what they're doing with the ball, you know, and they're throwing the ball at 100 miles an hour at each other and, and they're not pitching either. They're bouncing it. So who knows where it's going to go? There's all that.
Yeah.
That's the primary difference between baseball and cricket in the terms of how they're pitching the ball is they bounce it. So you got guys who bowl it really fast and how it's going to turn, and the guys who bowl it slowly so they can make it turn.
Really?
And you know, it's I absolutely love it. And I'm glad Andre put you straight, because
Andre
but he won't put you straight about anything though. That's the...
I just talked to him last night,
because
I was gonna see if he could come down and do a set at my show tonight, but he's doing something, and I don't even understand. I really don't get I want to say, like, I don't even know. It's a flight, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And so he's like, I'll be back Thursday. We'll hang out Thursday. But, like, too much to talk about with that guy. Because, I have a lot of energy.
Yeah.
And I think Andre said to me one day, you cast a very large wake. I got him really pissed. I got him really pissed because I used to have a joke about getting in a fight with the black guy.
Yeah.
And we were in South Africa.
Yeah.
And, the joke was, and this is so hacky, I'm so glad I'm not doing this anymore.
The joke was
I was at a disadvantage because it was night. And I said, but fighting a black guy at night, it's like fighting Predator.
Right.
And you just hear, and then I said, it's like fighting a white guy in the snow.
Right.
And the joke was fighting an Asian at dusk.
Right.
And
what did Andre say about that?
They didn't get the joke. Fighting it, because Asian for them means something different than it does for me.
Yeah, yeah.
Asian for me means Chinese.
Yeah,
I think
for
them it means
people from India,
which
Pakistan,
are as dark as black people sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So this South African comic's like, you should say colored. He goes, that's our mixed. And I was like, oh yeah. So I do it on a show, and Andre lost his fucking mind. He lost his fucking mind.
Really?
He's like, how dare you? How dare you? You're better than that. And I was like, Jesus Christ. And I was. The poor South African comics, like, I told him, I gave him the line, and Andre's like, he's better than you. I mean, Andre can be a little bitchy at times.
Yes.
And so
First thing I ever did in Edinburgh was with Andre.
Really?
Yeah, like a mixed bill thing, right? Way back when. Yeah. Yeah, I've known Andre a long time. And yeah, he can be spiky, he can be bitchy. I mean, what I like about what he's also trying to provoke as well. He may not mean a word of it. And that's what I think he's quite fond of getting people to think, which is, I think, really quite unusual.
Yeah, it really is. So who were the guys you started with then? Like,
oh, God. Well, when I started out...
I wish I knew names better.
Oh, well, so people like Harry Hill, Stuart Lee. I
know the name Stuart Lee.
Yeah. He's a big cheese here. He's a sort of comics comic as well as the thing he's... I mean, although, you know, British people listening to this will pounce on that, but that's kind of... He did a lot of stuff about comedy and comic expectations and audiences and this sort of stuff in a couple of TV shows he did where he kind of laid into quite a few people.
Really?
And a little bit of me and all this sort of thing. It's quite funny because we used to live together. So you're kind of like, hey, Stu, what are you fucking doing?
Yeah.
Come on. And I know why he was doing it. I don't know what it's about, but it's kind of a... God, who else? I mean, when I was very first starting out, people like Eddie Izzard and Lee Evans were breaking through, you know, big names here. Peter Kay, and then Dylan Moran, and God, who else? Bill Bailey. A whole lot of people. When I, you know, were either up and running when I was getting going, or kind of contemporary with me a bit. The League of Gentlemen guys who've gone on to do other, they weren't stand up, so they like sketch people, and they did a really important, I mean, you know, like seminal sketch show here, and then have gone into doing other really great TV.
Yeah.
I don't know who else.
I'm right now. My British fans are losing their mind, going, "How the fuck do you not know? How are you not jumping all over this?"
But my favorite people of all, though, when I the people who made me go, "Holy shit!" You know, comedy is like the most exciting thing imaginable. Are an Australian group, guys called the Doug Anthony All Stars, who were a musical trio, and I saw them in 1988 in Edinburgh when I was a student, and it was one of those things where you leave the show and you go and buy a ticket to come back immediately, you know, like, and we queued in the street and everything, and they were extraordinary, and like they were dressed like sort of punk mariachis, and they sang really filthy, really on the nose stuff, and they didn't, you know, political correctness was kind of on its way up, establishing itself, that, you know, late 80s, they did not give a shit for it. And they really? Would, their view was, this is comedy. So we're at the, you know, to use a modern parlance, the safe space is here in the theater where we can say whatever we want. And it doesn't matter. And none of it matters. And I'm joking, you know, and they'd go on in the Fringe in the old days at a place like the Fringe Club and go, you know, "Good evening, London," like that. And the Scottish people, you know, that's like, as incendiary as you can be in Scotland, they'd go nuts and they'd go, "Oh, come on, we're fucking joking, mate. You know, what's your problem?" And that's always, and they were brilliant. And I saw them, I mean, must have been a half dozen times, and I was open for them two or three times when I was just starting out. And then they went back to Australia and they're massive stars in Australia. And
really?
Did their own thing. The year before last, one of them, Tim, one of the guys in it, Tim Ferguson, he got MS, and he's really ill with MS properly, and he's in a wheelchair, and he's sick with it. But he's like this, he's undimmed by it. He's ill. Yeah, getting around's more difficult, but that hasn't got in the way. And they reformed 2 years ago, and I got them to... produced them, brought them over to Edinburgh last year because I had to see it again. And they did this show that was the most amazing, like, amazing, life-affirming, totally, genuinely edgy thing you've ever seen. Because they've got a guy who's, you know, he looks like he's mortally ill, and they're taking the piss out of him, and they're taking the piss out of the situation and about out of the things people say about people who are ill or with disabilities, and they're... And it's funny, and the lead singer has got the most beautiful voice and a shit-eating grin, and one of the most charismatic people you'll ever hope to see.
Yeah.
And so none of it matters, you know. What they were doing was so well conceived because it was a it was a, you know, perfectly polished show. So, you know, like the performance, absolutely no flies on that.
Yeah.
The content was operating on about five levels at once. So you can just laugh at the knob gags if you want, or you can laugh at the sort of nihilism of it, or you can laugh at the sort of the way, the touching fact it's three friends who've got back together when one of them's in a really in a difficult situation in his life. Or you can laugh at the fact that they're being horrible. You know, if your taste runs to really black humor, you can laugh at that too. And they were a huge inspiration to me, you know, 30 years ago. And then to see them again last year, it was like, this is the shit. You know, this is why I got into it. This is what you want to do. You want to do an act that works on, you know, or my ambition, do an act that works on what you can take it in different ways if you want.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to be about one thing. You rely, and the other thing they do, which I really love in really great comics, let you make your mind up about what's going on. They don't come on and they tell you what to think. They tell you to think. You know, there's a massive difference between the two expectations. You know, if you're going to be a didactic comic,
yeah,
the way I much prefer it if you come away going, oh, that was interesting, rather than, oh yes, he's right about that. You know, I just
You know
what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. I have such a problem right now with agenda-driven comedy, which is the majority of a comedy that's coming out of Los Angeles and New York. I wouldn't say the majority, but I'd say there was a great deal of agenda.
There's enough
comedy.
Of it, yeah, for it to be, yeah.
And you're like, I will sit here and I will talk to you about gay rights or feminism or both, or I will talk to you about why Trump is the greatest. Like, I just don't like. I want to be provoked.
Yeah,
I want to be.
But you do get this cyclical thing though, where people confuse means and ends. So the end. The aim is to make people laugh, is to be entertained.
Right.
Right? That's the end. The means include being political, being really bad taste, being edgy, being dumb, being falling over, doing stupid puns, you know, doing wit, wordplay, storytelling, talking about yourself, being honest, being completely dishonest. Those are all the means at your disposal, but they're not the... They're not the point of it. So, we get these fashions here where we had a real fashion for the, and kind of the, where all the critics operate is at Edinburgh, because that's where you see the most comedy and you get to compare and contrast. So we've had phases where, you know, you've got to be really honest in a show and tell the absolute truth about yourself. You're going to think, well, I'm not interested in doing that. That's not comedy. That's a way of doing it. And then it shifts to why, you know, you need to be political. Well, that's just a way of doing it. You know what I mean? And you get this real proper confusion and audiences. I mean, the other thing is audiences don't go to comedy very often. Comics go to comedy all the time.
Yeah.
But audiences,
oh, I never thought about it that way.
You know what I mean?
I go to comedy all
the
fucking time.
You go to comedy all the fucking time. Audiences don't go very often.
They just go once a fucking year.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I've had people say to me, oh man, you know, on my fan page on Facebook, go, oh man, you know, how do I get to see you live? And you're like, well, I'm on tour again, right?
That's fucking insane.
And you're on the fan page. And the other thing is, you know, I'll tweet the tour dates and someone will go, hey, when are you coming to Truro, you know, which is down in Cornwall in the southwest?
Yeah.
And I'm like, the last date of the last tour was in Truro. Oh, why didn't I know about this? Because you're an incurious dick, right? because you're not that big a fan, or you'd have found out.
Incurious dick. That's great.
And they go, oh, it's not very well advertised. So, well, it was sold out. So it was perfectly well advertised.
Yeah, yeah.
And people are, you know, but that is that thing. Comics go to comedy a lot more than audiences. So we notice the trends in maybe a way audiences just don't and aren't interested in.
I'm always blown away when, and this has been happening a lot lately, when people go, this was my first comedy show.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just want to go, oh, why did you pick me?
Yeah, well, no,
I literally say to myself, so out of all the really great ones, you pick, I'm grateful, thank you, really?
Yeah.
Like, you definitely should have gone seen Dave Attell. You should have seen Bill Burr, Dave Attell, Louis C.K.
But I get this too. You know, you're my first ever comedy show. Going to be seeing some more now. And you kind of think, well, that's good.
Yeah.
Right? That's good. You know, it's all good in that respect. But kind of like, what distortion of expectations has happened if they've come and seen me first?
Yeah.
You know, whoever they go and see, you know, won't do half an hour of basically calling the people at the front wankers, you know, like, you know, or whatever, or maybe they're going to think all stand-ups are characters now, or you know, just don't know.
So interesting.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny.
Now, what's a punter when you call someone a punter?
Oh, it's an audience member. It means somebody's paying. I mean, it's actually an old word the prostitutes used for their johns, you know, like a punter, yeah.
It's so funny as I watch your act, I have the opportunity to ask him what that word means because I'll see him later. Yeah. Like one of the things I thought I was like, this is going to sound horrible, but how does divorce work here? Is it the same in the States where they get half your money? Or do you have to pay them? Is there alimony?
Well, yeah, there's alimony. And
it's the same?
Yeah, although yours differ from state to state, though, don't they? As well, California.
LA, they get half immediately.
Oh.
For the rest of your life, you get half your money.
Oh, no. Here it's different. Here it all changed about, I mean, I've been divorced twice, so you're talking to the right guy. My first marriage, we kind of earned the same. We had some joint savings. We just bought a house and we just split all down the middle and off we went. And I didn't owe her any money. She didn't owe me any money. We didn't have any kids. So we didn't have any ongoing obligations. And that's what the law.
Was she in the arts too?
Yeah, she worked in television. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, we went our separate ways and that was the end of that. And the law, that's what the law did in that instance. But my second marriage, you know, we got kids and so, you know, I did the biggest tour I've ever done where I did arenas and stuff, was when I was getting divorced and just in the like last month I was touring, we did a load of arena shows and that's when the settlement got drawn up. And I remember looking at the audiences thinking, you fuckers, because they're sat there thinking, wow, he's doing well. You know, he's making a few quid here. This is good. Cause we did, you know, we ended up at the O2, which is like 15,000 people, did two nights of that, did arenas all over the country. And you could tell that they're thinking, you know, the boy's done good and all that. And I didn't see a penny from that tour because it all went into the divorce settlement.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And so you're looking out there thinking this, and you're on stage thinking, this should be my moment of triumph.
Oh, fuck
and
me.
And it fucking isn't. It fucking isn't. And the long and short of it is I didn't want that marriage to end at the time. Yeah. Although, you know, I'm well out of it on reflection. But so you're thinking, I've got to give all these people this fucking money because of that woman. Ah, you know, and the thing is that show didn't really have anything about that in it at all. I hadn't put it through the filter, you know, put it through the mincer. I mean, other stuff has since turned up and a lot of other stuff since.
Really?
You know, but that's what I do with the act anyway. You feed a subject and it comes out backwards. You know, there's a friend of mine who I've used who's a religious guy who I've used quite a lot, but he'd never recognized the thing he said, how it's gone in, come processed and come out the other end.
That's my problem.
10-minute routine, you know?
I say their name in it. I did this joke about this kid. this kid's name's John Henry in my last special. I met his mom at a orientation for school, and she said, my son's name's John Henry, and that's what I call my dick.
Right,
So I start talking to her about John Henry, about he's my best friend, he lives down south, his next-door neighbor's an asshole, he's got two roommates. And so I do the whole thing, and then I tag it differently than it really happened.
Yeah.
This was, Georgia was in first grade, she's in seventh now, so this was like 6 years ago. She emailed my wife and was like, I'm assuming the joke about Bert's dick is my son. And I was like, it's a true story. That's his name.
Yeah,
it's a real person.
Yeah.
And
I don't call your boy John Henry.
Yeah. And she and my wife's like, oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. And we don't speak to them. We don't go to school with them anymore. But like, I was like, and so that's my problem is the story that I have that it went viral. It's like got 23 million views. It's about the Russian mafia. The reason it went viral is because the first people to comment were the kids in my class that I robbed.
Oh my God.
and they were the first people to comment, and they started tagging each other in it, going, "Hey guys, this is Bert's story," and they were like, and they were writing in, "The story is 100% true. We were on this train. He robbed us." And then they started putting pictures of the trip, of the robbery, on the comment section. And so people saw it, and their first instinct was, "Hold on, what I'm about to see is 100% true, and I didn't change anyone's name. I left everyone's name the same."
Yeah.
And so everyone, and then everyone that had heard it before, you know, maybe a million people, 2 million people that heard it before, all then went to it and went, "Hold on, that shit was true." And then they went,
they share it,
and so then that was like the fucking crazy. That's my problem, is I fucking keep it so Like and so I'm doing jokes about my daughters, and as I punch them up, they're like, "Hold on, that's not true." And you're like, "Fucking, cut me some slack." Isla's really dyslexic, okay? Yeah, that's crazy. That really is. So when you, I want to ask, I know this is, we've been on for about an hour 15.
Cool.
I won't go too much longer.
Yeah, no worries.
But I am curious, because I watched a documentary about Russell Brand.
Yeah.
About him trying to get into politics.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you actually went and ran for parliament.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, that
was because of Russell.
Really?
To a greater lesser degree, yeah. Well, and also because the pub landlord, right, is anti-European and all this sort of stuff. But when I first started doing him, that was a fringe opinion, being really obsessed and sort of hallucinating about what the EU was like, was a fringe opinion. And now it's squarely in the mainstream of British
What's
politics.
The country where you go, they're surrounded by this, surrounded by this? This
is Switzerland,
That's a flat you wouldn't
sell. Yeah, you'd never sell that flat, yeah. Yeah, Germans upstairs, Austrians to the right of them, French to the left of them, Italians down below. You'd never sell that fucking flat. Yeah. And that was a fringe opinion, and it's completely mainstream now. So, and also because Russell had and the thing Russell did in the midst of all that is at one point he said, "I don't vote. Why don't you vote? I don't vote because, as far as I can tell, it doesn't make any difference or anything. What's the point, right?" And the problem with that, for me, is, as we've seen, it really does make a difference. And that's how you get President Trump, is because people vote.
Yeah.
And also because people don't vote when they ought to, right?
A lot of people said, "I don't want to vote for either of them," so they just didn't vote.
Well done. Bravo. And, you know what I mean? And the thing is, I'm nowhere near as well as known Russell, as well known as Russell, but I just sort of thought, The problem here is this sort of, because it's a kind of fashionable nihilism. It's a fashionable shrug, and it doesn't get anyone anywhere. So I thought, rather than do the didactic thing of going, "Well, you ought to vote," I thought I'd just get involved. I'd do a thing where we ran a completely joke campaign, and we ran where this guy Nigel Farage, who's been one of the driving forces of this Brexit thing, where he was running because he was trying to get into Parliament. I thought, well, we'll run there. It's the obvious place to run because it's where all the attention for those ideas will be.
Yeah.
And it'll be really, really funny, right? And we ran a completely fake joke campaign. And, you know, we did a 10-point manifesto, like, we're going to put an extra 20p into the pound so the pound is worth £1.20, right? Shit like that. Anyone who goes to hospital and there's nothing wrong with them will be sent, you know, to the emergency room or hospital. And there's nothing wrong with them will be sent to other departments to be practiced on. All this sort of stuff, right?
Yeah.
All the hot political issues. We had a joke, you know, 12-gag manifesto. You know, Britain will be leaving the EU. We'll be leaving Europe by 2020 and the solar system by 2050. That's sort of shit, right?
Yeah.
And we formed a political party, registered it properly, and I registered to run for Parliament, and we did all the stuff. And the thing is, I mean, and we did it because, rather than just say, "Hey kids, you should vote. Voting's kind of your duty, or voting's cool, or voting is your voice, your chance to change things." Just put yourself up for election, and then, you know, because that's the way of, if you're a comic, that's a more effective way of doing it and a funnier way of doing it. And the shit we got for it was amazing.
Really?
Yeah, people really livid with me, mainly Farage's supporters, who just could not cope with their guy being laughed at, or someone trying to laugh at their guy.
Yeah.
They just could not handle it.
Now, who is this guy?
Oh, well, God, there's a there in hangs a tale.
Did he elected?
No. So he didn't win. I picked up 318 votes on the night, which I lost the office sweepstake. We had a bunch of us working on the project, and I thought I was going to get about 700. So, I was, you know, usual thing. I can't estimate how many people there are. And he didn't win, and it was a big setback for him the year before last, him not winning. It was like, and I got myself on stage next to him when they announced the result and did all this, oh my God, you know, it's terrible. If you look it up on YouTube, Al Murray and Nigel Farage, South Thanet, I put, because what they do, I mean, the really funny thing about this is a load of conspiracy theories on the internet sprung up as to why I was doing it, as to why I'd run. And you could tell people till you're blue in the face, I'm doing it because we're joking, you know, we're just taking the piss. Don't worry about it. Get over it.
Yeah.
You know, and you could tell people that to your blue in the face and go, no, there's more to it than that. The BBC have put you up to it. And I don't work for the BBC. The BBC have been given money by the EU and they've put you up to it. Don't know what you're talking about. And there was one that I was, there's a persistent rumor that I'm a cousin of David Cameron, who's the former prime minister, and that he put me up to it. And that's an amazing, that's just the most brilliant bit of conspiracy stuff, because my family, you know, I said my family's kind of posh.
Yeah.
There's this thing where the author of Vanity Fair, a guy called William Thackeray, is my great-great-great-grandfather. There's just a thing I know about my family, right?
He started Vanity Fair?
He wrote the book that the magazine's named after.
Oh, really?
Satirical novel. He was a contemporary of Dickens. But it means jack shit now.
Yeah.
But it's just a thing I know about my family. And so it comes up. And so there's this website that do people's family trees, genealogy website, and they'd found someone in Thackeray's family married to someone in Cameron's family. And they do a press release every year where they put this stuff up. So people go, oh, that's interesting. I'll go look at my family tree.
That's so funny.
And it's mad. And the year before, they'd done Obama and the Kardashians or something. You know, because to be honest, you go far enough back with anyone, everyone's related. It's just sort of bullshit. Anyway, so Cameron and I, we are not cousins, not by any measure. It's two people in our families 200 years ago who got married, but we're not the product of that.
Yeah.
You leave that alone on a message board, and it turns into, he's my first cousin and he's put me up to doing it, he's paying me to do it.
Oh,
and I'd have people on a daily basis on Twitter, more than a daily basis, saying that to me, because they've obviously been off on some message board for idiots and discussed it and come up with their theory. It was amazing. So there's that conspiracy theory. Because the idea that a guy would just do it to take the piss, the simplest explanation.
Yeah.
Was too difficult.
It was too hard for them to wrap their head around.
Yeah, exactly. But we did, you know, we ran this campaign where I was going to, because there's this thing where they put candidates into seats in this country. They call it parachuting a constituency in.
Yeah.
Right. It's what a constituent in, where they're parachuting a candidate in rather to the constituency. And so we were going to do a thing where I literally parachuted in, right. I was going to do a tandem jump and all this shit. Because it seemed, you know, actually do the thing literally as a gag seemed like a good idea at the time. And we've run the phone and sorting this thing out. And they go, and you've got to weigh less than whatever it was, 90 kilos. You know, if you weigh more than that, you can't do it. So I get on the kid's scales at home, my daughter's scales at home, and I'm underweight. I'm like, brilliant, you know, let's do it. I get there the next morning and I'm about to get on this. I'm about to parachute. About to go and draw my parachute or whatever.
Yeah.
Get on the scales, too heavy. So we had to cancel it. And so I had to do we had all these journalists there, all these TV networks.
Oh,
so I had to come out and do this statement. Like a proper politician, when something goes wrong and they've got to spin it. So I had to come out and do all this, you know, I've been held back by health and safety gone mad and all this sort of shit. And I'm the, you know, another victim of the obesity epidemic and all this sort of... thing. And even then you had people, the conspiracy people online going, he was never going to do it. He was never going to jump. This is a stunt. You can't, no, I was going to jump. I was going to, why would I lie? Why would I say I'm a beast on purpose? But you know, but politics. And the thing is a lot of what was going on in the election, and this was this time 2 years ago, started in January through February. A lot of what was going on, I didn't realize, was basically how everything was going to turn out. In the second half of last year, you know, when everyone all these sort of, and it's the sort of the lunatic fringe. You think everything's a conspiracy, and that there's some sort of phantom establishment working against them the whole time. That people believe that shit.
Yeah, some of my friends.
Really?
So, oh yeah, of course. Conspiracy theory is really big in LA. Like, and I'm even prone to it. Like, I'll fall into some conspiracies where you're like, yeah, what is that fucking deal?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, like, my conspiracy theories are, like, hardcore, and I can't even share them because people really go, you don't really fucking believe that, do you? Yeah.
I always think the main thing with conspiracy theories is it shows what great faith people have in government. You know, if the government could pull off half the stuff it's accused of doing, then the government's amazing. You know, like, you know what, yeah, I mean?
That's one of the things, like the big 9/11 conspiracy, yeah, that they put people on planes and flew them into Cuba, and you're like, and none of those people talk, like, come on.
Yeah. Like, well, the moon landing, you know, like, what is it, 100,000 people worked on the moon landing?
Yeah, and three black chicks.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
My daughters are obsessed with that movie. They're obsessed. This is a baby birth of a bit that one day when I'm a better comic, I'll be able to work on.
Yeah.
But they are hardcore feminists.
Oh, superb.
And but they say things. They're 10 and 12.
Yeah.
So they say things that is the rhetoric of what is happening at our college campuses right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Where it's thought policing. It's censorship. It's liberalism run amok a tad bit.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, right now, our liberals are supporting Sharia law.
Yeah.
Like,
we've had that in the left here for quite a while where Islamists are getting a kind of free pass because no one wants to be accused of being racist.
No one wants to be Islamophobic in the States.
Yeah, exactly.
Same thing. Then they go, yes. Then they turn an eye, blind eye to the fact that they kill homosexuals.
I had a big chunk of material about that in my show before last.
Really?
Yeah, which was like, if you want to...
Where do I hear this?
It's on the last DVD I did. We do this whole thing about, you know, if you want to get away with something terrible, all you got to do is say, no, it's the way of my people. And then, people go, oh, it's all right then, you know, do what you want.
Yeah. I don't get the backlash from Muslims, progressive Muslims saying, we need to further the culture and make it so that we don't stone women for adultery.
Well, yes,
genital mutilation.
I can never remember her name. Ayaan Ersan Ali, she's called something like that, who's a progressive, and she's had a clitoris removed. She's been through all that.
I love that chick.
Declared against her religion. And you got people, liberal people, who hate her. And you're like, are you nuts? Imagine how dangerous that life is. Imagine how dangerous that existence is. And all she's agreeing with is the idea of universal human rights. And, you know, liberalism is about universalism, isn't it? It seems it's got its, you know, people have got themselves in a pickle, haven't they?
It doesn't make sense to me. This is why I do think your pub landlord would work so well in the States.
Well,
because there's such a confusion of thought. You know, it used to be the conservatives were trying to, the Republicans and the hard right wing conservatives were trying to squash freedom of speech.
Yeah.
Now the liberals are saying, if you don't say what we want you to say, we don't want you to speak.
Yeah,
I don't know if you know who this Milo Yiannopoulos is.
Oh, certainly I do, yeah.
Oh, I find him fucking fascinating.
Yeah.
I find him fascinating because he's pretty much just a troll. He's a conservative gay guy. I've listened to him on podcasts before. He is very intelligent.
Yeah.
He's fun to listen to, but I don't agree with him. I do believe he should say whatever the fuck he wants to say to whoever wants to listen.
This is the dilemma, isn't it, right now?
Yeah.
This is the dilemma right now. And what will happen, though, is there will be a natural reaction to that, that in itself, there'll be a pushback, won't there? Because there's got to be, isn't there? Otherwise, you're going to end up with censored complete censorship.
100% censorship.
And no one's interested in, no one's actually interested in that. Because, of course, the mistake people who push for against freedom of speech always forget is that if they're calling for someone else's to be restricted, they're calling for their own.
Yeah.
Because you know, your rights are my rights. And once I've shut you up, there's nothing to stop someone else shutting me up.
That is where I go, you know, it's be careful. It's better to date the devil, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, dear, transgendered, non-binary students, yeah, who don't want Milo Yiannopoulos, yeah, to speak, guess what? When you censor that speech, the person that's going to love it the most might be Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And I promise you, in a second, yours will be the first one he takes away.
Oh, yeah.
Because no one wants to hear from that minority of the population. The number of transgendered people in the United States is smaller than the number of albinos in Tanzania. Mm. And so I guarantee you I just don't get it. Like, I don't talk about politics much on stage, only because I go, you just end up looking like, you just end up looking bad, you know, yeah, like for me, because yeah, I'm a big party guy. I tell big stories.
Yeah, yeah.
People are like, listen, man, I came out to party. I came out to have a good time. You blew me away at the statement. You forget how little people go see stand up considering, yeah, to what we see it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, this might be their only fucking time, yeah, this year.
Or ever.
Or ever.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. But yeah, but you're right. And there is a real problem with this. I mean, my daughter's 17, and I remember we were talking about offense, you know, and I said, well, come on, you know, the way you can look at it is offense is there to, people take offense, don't they?
Yeah.
You know, they don't have a right to take offense. They choose to take it. She's like, oh, you're just playing word games, Dad. And I could hear her trotting out like a standardized reply to that idea. And I know that idea is a standard idea as well, that, oh, people take offense and no one has a right to be offended and everything. But you could hear that she'd equipped herself with the standard reply. And then we were talking about it a couple of days later. She goes, no, that's actually, you're right. That's bullshit, the thing I was trying out on you, that, yeah, argument. If there's no right to say offensive things, there's no right to say anything. Because anything is offensive if you decide to make it so, isn't it? Absolutely anything. And if you get into religion and blasphemy, everything's blasphemous if it, yeah, doesn't agree with that religion. You know, we've got this problem with blasphemy here.
But just what's blasphemy is when you talk against God.
Yeah, when you talk about, you know, when you disrespect a religion, basically.
Yeah.
And you know, we used to have blasphemy law here.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But that was built around the Christian church, you know, because the church is part of the state. The Anglican church, the Church of England, is part of the state here. So it had legal protections built in. And they were got rid of, I think, maybe 50 years ago. And there's been a pushback since to try and get it for other minority religions. You're kind of like, fuck off. Fuck off. And there was quite a robust campaign against it, you know, 3-4 years ago. You know, I think I signed a petition, but you're just thinking, you know, this is just fuck off. You know, no argument really with, yeah, it. Just like, fuck off, don't tell me what I can and can't say. You know, and the thing is, I get that there are things that are rude and things you don't say at dinner parties and things that, but you, the moment you start saying that it's illegal to use certain kinds of speech, you are screwed.
100%.
And we don't have the First Amendment here. We don't have it. We've got this sort of weird thrashed out version of freedom of the press, but we don't have the First Amendment. So we don't have that protection.
What does that look like?
Well, it looks like, because we, you know, we don't have a written down constitution here. We have this, yeah, sort of amorphous set of traditions, and some of it's written down, and some of it's all really old.
I'm so happy that you rightfully assume what I don't know, because I'm like, yeah, I had no fucking clue.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah,
well, we've got this weird, like, half. It's, there's a lot of precedent, and there's old stuff that suddenly is important and then disappears again, and then just establish practice in our government and all that sort of thing. But we don't, like I said, we don't have, so there is no First Amendment. We have no First Amendment rights in this country. So there's this really weird version of press freedom we got. And, you know, we had a big scandal 3-4 years ago with people hacking telephones and spying on people in the media, you know, like newspapers doing that.
I heard about that.
Yeah, and the police got involved in that. Celebrities got involved. And some of the papers behaved disgustingly. But then the next thing,
was
you know...
Was it The Sun?
Yeah, it's The Sun and the News of the World. And the News of the World, which was a big Sunday newspaper scandal sheet, got shut down, you know. Rupert Murdoch, you know, the scandal was so massive.
I remember this.
Yeah, the scandal was so massive, he closed the paper. Because they'd hacked a dead girl's... A girl had been murdered's phone. To see what messages, you know, if there are any answer phone messages on it, you know, while she was missing. And the scandal became so enormous that Murdoch shut the paper down. But that scandal is a terrible business. But the next thing you know, you've got the government going, or bits of politicians saying, well, yeah, we should control the press, actually. And you're like, hold on a fucking second.
Yeah.
No, we shouldn't. You know, and especially with the internet. And I was involved in this thing called the Twitter joke trial.
Yeah, you tweeted what they deemed an obscene...
No, he tweeted what they deemed to be a terror threat. So it's this guy...
Oh, that's right.
And this is when... this is when there were like...
Wait, tell me all of this.
All right, okay. I'll tell you right from the start. This is a good story because it's really mad, right?
Yeah.
This is 5 years ago. So it's when... Or 6 years ago, 5 years ago. It's when Twitter... You know, when I got 400,000 followers, something like that now. And at the time, I had 3,000. Twitter was... miniature at the time, and there was this guy called Paul Chambers, who was a trainee accountant, and he'd met a girl on Twitter who lived over in Northern Ireland, and he was going to go see her because they were finally going to go meet, you know, Paul and Sarah, and he goes and looks on the, and he was a week before he was going, he looks on the internet, looks at the weather at the airport he was flying out from, and it was snowing, so he tweets, crap. And the airport was called Robin Hood Airport. He goes, crap, Robin Hood Airport is closed. They have just over 7 days to get their shit together or I'm blowing the place sky high, right? It's a joke. That is a joke, right?
A joke.
Just over a week to get their shit together. As threats go, you know.
Just over a week.
Just over a week. It's a joke, right? And he'd been talking to her already in the mentions, joking about, oh, shit, I can't come and see you. What if the weather goes wrong? I really want to see, you know, like having a conversation. So the Sunday night, the off-duty security guy at the airport does a Google search or a Twitter search on what people are saying about the airport.
Yeah.
Right? Paul's tweet comes up. And I don't think anyone retweeted it or liked it or favorited it or whatever. Paul's tweet comes up and he's going, oh, blimey, that has the shape of a terror threat. I better tell my boss. So in the morning, he tells his boss.
Oh, yeah. Let's sleep on it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Goes in Monday morning, tells his boss. His boss goes, well, you know the protocol. We've got to report it to the police. So they report it to the police. And the next thing Paul knows, the police turn up at his office and arrest him for a malicious... communication under the Electronic Communications Act or whatever it was, of 2003, which is a bit of law written in 2003 or in 2002, I can't remember anyway, by the government at the time, the Blair government, because of 9/11. Because after 9/11 and after the war in Afghanistan, you had people doing websites where they'd film a 9/11 going, look at, you know, isn't this brilliant? Look at the infidels copying it. And they'd have film of car bombs blowing up in Afghanistan going, you know, another infidel bites the dust.
Yeah.
Well, that horrible shit, right? Horrible shit, but that has political context, but horrible shit. So they passed an act to get those websites shut down. Paul's tweet fell under that law, right? One way or another.
Yeah.
So he loses his job as a trainee accountant.
Jesus.
He's found, I can't remember if he was told to plead guilty at the time, but anyway. So he gets a suspended sentence or whatever. Now, of course, he then wants to go and live with Sarah because they're in a relationship, but she lives in Northern Ireland where there's a long history of terrorism. And poor old Paul is trying to move to somewhere where they take a pretty dim view about people with,
with terror
convictions.
Yeah, terror convictions.
I mean,
yeah,
totally fucking farcical. So I got involved in the appeal to you know, and you know, this is a early Twitter campaign, and a load of there was a load of people tweeting I'm Spartacus, and a load of people tweeting the same tweet, you know, holy, you know, crap, Robin Hood airport's closed. Loads of people tweeting the same tweet, and very often attaching their local police station and going, when are you going to arrest me? Do you want me to come down the station?
Oh my God.
You know, and I think someone did go down the station. They told, you know, they said, you're wasting, we'll arrest you for wasting police time. Fuck off, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I got involved with them. We did a gig. We did quite a big gig, quite a starry gig for Paul and to raise his legal fees. And we had one appeal hearing with one of the top lawyers in the country. And I said we got no first. I know I said we got no First Amendment thing, but we've got this weird thing called Article 10, which is a bit of European law that we got from when we were in the EU, which still counts but will disappear.
Yeah,
which gives you a right to a freedom of expression, but qualified within certain. You know, it's a woolly bit of European law.
Yeah.
Right? So, and the problem is...
I'm still stuck on, I'm blowing this thing sky high.
No, it's just bullshit,
it's just
isn't it?
Such a funny... They got a week to get their shit together, or I'm blowing this shit sky high.
And the thing is, all the papers said he made a bomb threat. He didn't. He said he was going to blow the place sky high. He didn't specify how.
Yeah.
And then you'd have people saying, well, it's like when you get to customs and they say, what have you got in your bag? And you go, I've got a hand grenade. And you're going, no, it isn't like that. Because he didn't fucking do that. He made a crap joke on Twitter. Anyway, so we didn't win our first appeal. So then we they had two judges and it drew. So we went to the High Court and got the Lord Chief Justice, you know, he decided to hear it.
Yeah.
Because there'd been a lot of stuff in the paper saying, this is ridiculous. And what happened is it shifted from the papers going, well, he's a silly boy, to the press realizing that it was, you know, ridiculous.
Yeah.
And we got all the way, you know, we got all the way to the top and defeated the government. And it was fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
But since then, people have been jailed for jokes since because their lawyers don't know that you know, we've got this precedent and they get them to say,
just plead guilty and just take the plea. You're not going to go to jail.
And actually what they should do is dispute it and not, because no one ever goes to jail for this. They get a criminal record. They get it on their record, you know, which is bullshit.
Yeah.
And there's some people, I mean, there have been some people tweeting really vile things, but still, you know, the freedom of speech means we now know that guy's an arsehole. If that's what freedom of speech is for, it's for revealing things as much as anything else. And
thank God, because I go through, people tweet mean shit, and then I go through their timeline and I go, oh, that's all you do.
Yeah.
That's who you are. You're blocked. You're muted.
Yeah, I know who you are now. Thanks. You know, exactly. But no, this Twitter joke trial was a really big deal at the time. You know, and we got Paul off and he, you know, his life continues now. He's sort of, but I got involved because if I'd tweeted that gag, no one would have batted a fucking eyelid because I'm a comic. So they go, oh, well, you've got your license. You have the freedom to do that. And idiots should be allowed to make jokes as well.
Is your dad still alive?
Yeah. Yeah.
Was he a conservative guy or liberal guy or?
Well, my dad was. Well, that's a good question.
He was in the military, right?
Yeah, he was in the military, and then he worked at the railway when it was you know, nationalized. It was the state railway, and in the army they all thought he was a socialist, and in the railway they all thought he was, you know, a conservative. So he likes playing devil's advocate, my dad. So
oh yeah,
yeah.
What does he think of the pub landlord?
He loves it. And he does that thing. I don't know which bits I agree with and which bits are obviously just jokes.
That's fucking great.
Which I love. And my mum doesn't like the bad language, but
oh really?
That's mum's for you, really. Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, she can't stand it. I know she can't stand it.
Oh, by the way, your mum would hate my act.
Well, yeah. Ugh. Just going, oh, I don't know how you remember it all. That's what she was kind of, only, you know, and I'm kind of like, mum, it's all right. That bit's good. But I do wish, because I used to have this, really, I had this routine where I'd say cunt like 35, 40 times.
Yeah.
Well, I'd do this thing of two British guys talking about the weather and then talking about sports. Because in this country, it's a different word. it's not quite as offensive.
Don't worry, I say it in my act.
Well, cool, yeah, but yeah. But I know because in America, with friends, a conversation drop the C-bomb, and they're like, oh my God, I can't believe you.
Oh, that's changed a tad bit.
Oh, is it? Oh, good.
Yeah, it's, and I don't know what made it change. Maybe not to everyone. Like I just said it in Lexington, Kentucky, where you'd think that would it gets an audible gasp.
Yeah.
Like it, but I don't think it's as bad as it was 10 years ago.
Well, before I did a lot of telly, I'd do it in a show and no one would bat an eyelid in the live show. You do some TV and then you get a whole load of new people come see you and they're like, they're amazed anyone will say it even out loud, you know. And I used it once in this show, the current show, right at the top of the show because I think what we're going to do is, you know, set out my stall. Here it comes, you know, anything can happen from now on. And
do all your hours turn into DVDs?
This last one hasn't because the arse has fallen out of the DVD market.
But I mean, are you recording them all and putting them online?
Yeah, I'm recording all of them. Yeah.
And put them online.
We haven't recorded this one yet.
I love that. It's the best thing.
Yeah.
I literally was going through. I mean, I watched your TED talk. I watched.
Oh, really?
Oh, because it started with someone sending me one clip.
Yeah.
That's one guy and he knows who he is. Because I put it out in the podcast and I was like, I want to podcast someone, a British comic that I don't know.
Yeah.
And he sent me the clip. He's like, watch this and fucking hit him up. And I watched it and I was like, oh, nice. And then at first I was like, and then you were like, yeah. And then I was like, oh, wait, this is a character. And then I was like, oh, shit. And then I was like, oh, my God, he shaves his head before he goes out on tour?
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's fucking insane.
Yeah, I'm not bald. You know, I had 2 weeks ago, I had a full head of hair and a beard and everything. And I get this thing, my partner, she's going, oh, no, is it all going to come off? And I'm like, yeah, got, you know, the people think I'm fat and bald, so I've got to give them that.
God damn it. I'll tell you what, man, this has been an absolute treat. I could talk
likewise, we could talk forever, couldn't we?
I could literally talk to you forever. I want you to come to the States, and I want you to do it. I want you to do some dates.
I'll speak to my manager, and we'll
talk to your manager and tell him, like, get into, like, the New York Comedy Fest. I think they're probably booking that right now.
Yep.
Like,
when is it?
I don't know, but it's, I'm assuming it's probably summer. I'm just guessing.
Cool.
But or book a date at the Wilbur or at the Trocadero in L.A. in Philly.
Yeah.
But I think there's enough expats.
Yes, you probably make up the numbers anyway, because that's the thing. When you go abroad, you kind of kind of weird. You're playing an ex. I mean, the last time I was in New Zealand, I assumed it was all expats. It was only like half a dozen. But anyway, no, I wish I could come to your show tonight, but I've got drum business this evening, so I can't make it.
No, it's fucking late. I got hit up by a bunch of fans going, you have to do a show.
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay. I was like, there's no way I'm moving more than 100 tickets on Wednesday night. And I go, because Wednesday night's the only night I can work. I'm going to some castle with the girls tomorrow. And so I go, I'll just do 100. And I got an offer for a 600 seater. And I was like, no, there's no way I can sell 600 seats. And then just sold out in like a matter of minutes.
So that's what you want, though. You want the room to be hot.
Yeah, but I felt really guilty that I didn't at least do a little extra work and see if there was something in between 100 seats and 600 seats.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I got a lot of people going, you're doing something else, right? And you're like, oh, fuck. I was like, I can't turn it into a work week. And then part of me goes, I feel like they just want to drink with me anyway.
Yeah.
So I was like, just meet me at a pub.
Yeah.
I'll put out a pub that I'll go in one afternoon.
Well, how long are you here for?
I leave Sunday.
Ah, shit. Because I'd say I can't come out tonight and I'm working for the rest of the week. Otherwise, I'd say either we meet for drink or we go, you come see a show. But
I would love to see your show.
But yeah, they're all out of town.
Oh, yeah.
Is the problem.
It's the thing that sucks about being a comic. It's like the people you have the most in common with, the people that are easiest
you
to talk
see.
To, you never fucking see.
Yeah.
Me and my buddy just went, my best friend's a comedian, very, very popular. He's getting a lot of traction in the States right now. You'd love him. His name's Tom Segura. He's so fucking funny.
Yeah.
And we did a big podcast with Rogan about losing weight, and we got a reward because we both lost weight. Joe flew us up to San Francisco. And we were like, and he literally the whole time, he's like, we need to do this again, man. Like, we don't ever see each other.
Yeah.
Like, we only talk on the phone and we never spend any time. He's like, let's do a gig in New Mexico together. He's like, let's do a gig in Montana together. Somewhere where we don't have a following.
Yeah.
That you just go and do like a small theater and,
yeah.
it's no, not one person's. I mean, he's going to overwhelm ticket sales, obviously. But and we were like, yeah, let's do something like that. But yeah, that's why I want you to come to the States.
Okay. Well, yeah. Seriously, because it's a thing we've not got around to doing yet, and I do want to do. I mean, I do, because the thing is I one of the things I kind of I know what buttons to push here now, and I kind of know how to make that work, and I've figured that out for Australia a bit and New Zealand and everything, but never the States. And it would seem to me that that's, you know, that's the last thing to, because there's a bit of me that thinks, you know, we were talking about me about being lazy before. I can do this shtick here now till for the rest of my life if I want to, and yeah. it involves I've got to sit down and do the work to make it to come up with it, but it's
the tickets are selling themselves and you can just show up.
Yeah. It's all that. Like, so it'd be quite interesting to go somewhere where, you know, you walk on stage, you think, right, what the fuck is going
to
work?
It would be cool to see. It would be a really interesting experience to go to a place like New York with a bunch of expats that would come out to see you, but a bunch of New Yorkers who I think would fucking eat you alive. Yeah. They'd love you. They'd be like, I'm telling you, man, it's like, there's so much connectivity to what that character's saying and what's going on in our country right now. And so much.
Okay. Well, I'll make the necessary calls and it'll all be your fault if it doesn't work out.
So funny. I could have seen your show and you're doing a full blown character. Now he's not the pub landlord. He's a tire salesman and he's got an American accent.
Yeah, well,
and
you
he's
never
just
know.
Talking American politics.
You never know. That might be the way of doing it. You know,
God, that's so
rebadge
fucking,
it. Yeah.
Oh, well, dude, I really sincerely appreciate you doing this.
I know, my real pleasure. It's very nice to meet you.
I'll put this out next week.
Yeah, cool.
And do me a favor. Where can all my fans that are straight like Ohio, California, Florida, Texas, who have never heard of you, where can they find all your stuff?
Well, on YouTube. I mean, there's a...
YouTube is, like, you can find all his stuff.
All my stuff is on YouTube, God help me. Yeah.
All his stuff's on YouTube, and your Twitter's Al Murray.
At Al Murray. It's Al Murray. So it's at Al Murray.
But
the 318 is the people who voted for me. That's why it's on there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The 318.
What's Al short for?
Alistair.
I'm an Albert.
Are you?
Yeah. Everyone's making fun of me this week going, I can't believe you're an Albert.
So you went for the Bert and I went for the Al.
Yeah. I could have got it up with Butchie. Dude, thank
you
so
pleasure.
Much.
It's a real pleasure.
I appreciate it.
This episode was brought to you by The Machine.